When is a nation truly on the road to reconciliation? Well, it starts with a look at the past. Lebanon, marking 50 years since the first shots of a civil war, fueled by sea change in the wider region. Today, with Assad out in Syria, Iran on the back foot, Israel emboldened, we'll ask about the consequences of what looks like another sea change moment now. What lessons from the past? Remember, 1975 was before the Iranian Revolution and the rise of the Tehran-backed Hezbollah movement. We'll look back and ask why so many actors then are still players today, a half century later. What's changed? What's the same? And how does the next generation overcome those sectarian tensions that flare up again regularly in Lebanon? A 50-year funk that can be reversed? The protesters of 2019 certainly thought so. Those protests already 5 years old, though. Today in the France 24 debate, Lebanon then and now, this special edition in partnership with Lebanon's largest French-language daily newspaper, L'Orient Le Jour, a paper with an English edition from Beirut. Iva Kovic-Shaheen, editor-in-chief of L'Orient Today. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Anthony Tawil's Mahabar podcast retraces the modern history of Lebanon. You're on to season three?
We just announced the release of season three, yes.
And what does Mahabar stand for?
Mahabar means crossing in Arabic, and it was a word that is commonly used to refer to areas that were separated from each other, that were in conflict. And we chose to name it Mahabar because of that symbolism, but also for the other meaning the word carries, which is to cross from somewhere to another. And hopefully through a project like Mahabar, we hope to move away from a time of war, maybe to another time, to a different era.
All right, indeed. With us as well, he's a lecturer in Middle East Studies, Karim Emile Bitar, professor at St. Joseph University of Beirut, also at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome back to Al Arabi television Paris correspondent Dao Mawad. You are the author of All She Lost, The Explosion in Lebanon, The Collapse of a Nation, and The Women Who Survived, that book squarely about what happened at the port of Beirut in August of 2020. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me again.
It's now a relic in a museum, a bullet-riddled bus targeted as it crossed Beirut's working-class neighborhood of Ain el-Remeneh. Tensions had been brewing before April the 13th, 1975, spiking fast with Christian phalangists targeting Palestinian militants and Lebanese sympathizers who'd been returning from a rally.
This bus was the spark of the civil war in Lebanon. We want them to change the idea of this bus from a spark of the civil war to actually something that would teach us a very good lesson, which is that we are all losers if we get into any civil war. Nobody is going to win.
Karim Bitar, can you give us the short version, what that bus means?
That bus is a terrible symbol. This was the starting point of what we call the Lebanese Civil War, which was much more than a civil war, which was also a series of proxy wars, regional and international, regional powers competing on the Lebanese territory. The Lebanese war was triggered to a large extent by the presence of Palestinian armed revolutionaries, but this is not the only aspect of it. We tend to focus almost exclusively on geopolitics, and we tend to forget the deep social, economic, communal divides in Lebanon. If the bus triggered this war, it's because we were unable in the preceding decades to engage in a serious process of state building. We were still trying to accept, to live in this fantasy that there is this power sharing among communities that we call consensual democracy or consociational democracy, and we did not move towards democratic citizenship, towards equal rights between all Lebanese, while protecting...
Yeah, it divvied up, and it's still to this day, right? Divvies up important posts, president, speaker of parliament, prime minister, according to your sectarian belonging.
Absolutely. Sectarianism is one of the major problems in Lebanon. This does not mean that we can do away with the sectarian system from one day to the next. We live in a region where many people have existential angst. All the minorities live in fear. But there are ways to appease the existential angst of these minorities and move and accept liberal modernity, moves toward democratic citizenship. For example, our constitution was supposed to create a Senate where these communities would be represented, and then you can desectarianize the lower house. Our constitution was also supposed to move toward administrative financial decentralization. This would also have appeased the angst of those who live in fear, but ultimately, we will have to do away with sectarianism if we want to be able to fight corruption. Sectarianism is the last refuge of the scoundrels in Lebanon. When someone does not want to be, to have impunity, he hides behind his communal leaders.
Small nation, Lebanon, and I'll put it to you, Anthony Tawil. You had, as was just explained, these sectarian rivalries, but then on top of it, two waves of influxes of Palestinian refugees, and then it all erupts. Do we understand today why it erupted?
Well, in my experience and in the work that we've been doing with Mabar, it was more to look at what was happening or what happened after the war was over in 1990 and not look exactly at the reasons why the war erupted or what happened over the 15 years and how the war...
Is it a question that you've asked yourself?
Why did the war erupt?
Yeah.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And there is definitely many versions of, or many incidents and many that caused the war to erupt and that made it a sectarian and then a confessional, and but also had the ideologies at the beginning, the first 2 years. So, but for me, the problem was not necessarily why the war erupted, but why we did not reconcile the many reasons why there was war.
We'll get to that point, but what's significant in researching this, Dalal Mawad, is the Lebanese themselves don't even agree on how many victims there were that day.
That's true. So the figure we have is 150,000. That's from the International Red Cross. But there are other figures by other...
That's for the entire civil war.
Yes, for the entire civil war. And this tells you something very important is that to this day, the Lebanese, if you bring a group of young Lebanese together, they won't have the same narrative over the war. Many of them don't know anything about the war because today the majority of the Lebanese were born either after the war or were too young to remember it. So what we know from the war is the stories and tales of our parents and grandparents. It's what we've watched in movies. It's what we've read in books because there was no effort at the national level to talk about the war. And to this day, we still don't talk about the war and we don't want to talk about it. And this comes from the higher political level. There was no political willingness. And I give you a very good example. So in history books taught in schools in Lebanon, the war that is taught to kids ends with the Lebanese independence after the French mandate ended. We don't talk about the 58 war. There was a brief civil war in Lebanon in 58, which is kind of a prelude to this civil war. And we don't talk about the civil war. And the excuse that's been given is that there are many narratives out there. But that means, you know, it's still important to tell the story. There's something that was done in the Balkans after the Balkan War, and I wrote about this. It's called the multi-perspective approach to history, using oral history and history telling. And it's okay to just put out the multiplicity of perspective to be able to teach history. But to say that we're not going to tell you what happened because there are conflicting reports and narratives, there's some truth to every perspective and every narrative that's out there. And one doesn't negate the other. But these kids don't know anything, or they're being given a distorted picture of the war.
Yeah, before I turn to Eva Kovic-Chahine, I just want to hammer home that point. It's France 24's Serge Berberi who did filed this story, read by correspondent Rawad Taha. And the efforts to keep the memory of the past alive prove sometimes tricky in Lebanon.
Decades after the war, some figures still loom large. In the Christian neighborhood of Ashrafieh, the image of Bashir Jmail hangs prominently. A militia commander, then an elected president, he was assassinated before he could take office. His son Nadim meets us at the site of the 1982 bombing that killed his father.
The old militia leaders are still running the country because, in truth, our society never really told them, thank you, you fought your fight and tried to build the country your way, but now it's time to step aside, make room for a new generation. That's why we haven't fully turned the page on the war.
And the warlords are still deeply entrenched in the Lebanese political life. They head the main parties, sit in parliament, and hold sway over key institutions. But what about the younger generation, those born after the guns fell silent? In Lebanese classrooms, history stops at 1957.
What's April 13th?
Many students don't even know the date the war began. And for teachers, talking about a conflict that remains politically sensitive is no easy task.
We try to avoid stepping into controversial territory. Instead, we focus on building critical thinking, helping them understand the root causes of the conflict, both internal and external. It's a very delicate topic, especially since we don't have a single history textbook we can all rely on. There's no shared narrative.
Lebanon has never written its official history. The war is remembered differently by neighborhood, by community, even by family. There's no unified story, just fragments still waiting to be pieced together.
Eva Kovic-Chain, your reaction to that student, that pupil there, who doesn't know what April 13th, 1975 is?
Well, honestly, that's exactly what has been striking me a lot in also a lot of the commemorations happening around the 50th anniversary of the war. The youth is not there most of the time. The youth is not mentioned. And further than that, education is never mentioned. And that is something that Al mentioned earlier. But further than that, when I say education, I don't just mean teaching them about the history of the war itself, but teaching them citizenship, teaching them civic engagement. That is something that is completely absent in the educational system today, at least in a form where it could lead to something concrete. And I say that as someone who grew up here and who went to school here. So today we're left with a youth that not just doesn't know much about the war itself, but is completely disinterested in the future. And when we talk about reform, when we talk about a project for Lebanon, when we talk about moving forward, institutions and reforms are downstream from culture. So we cannot move forward when the people themselves are disinterested, when the people that have to live in that future are disinterested. We won't also have anyone to ask for accountability if there's no one to know how to ask for accountability. So yes, it's a very complex question on different levels. So there's education about the history itself, education about citizenship. There is coming up with the multi-perspective version that Al mentioned as well.
It's not that involved in the commemorations. Eva, growing up, what was the moment of the Civil War that your family told you about?
I think the Ayn al-Rumayna is like the gimmick that everyone mentions always, and then depending on which community you're from or which place you're from, people will remember different things. But it never goes beyond the event itself. It never really went into the whys, into the how to also get out of it.
All right. There's a bigger monument to the Civil War than that bus that we showed from that day.
Absolutely.
That's hiding in plain sight near the Corniche beachfront of Beirut. We're talking about the Holiday Inn. It was inaugurated in 1974, abandoned 1 year later after its use by snipers along the front line. Today, the Holiday Inn, as you can see, these are images from the day of snipers in there. It's still there. It's still unoccupied. It's still this monument. What's it like when you live in Lebanon? People, I remember being struck seeing it because I'd seen it on TV as a boy every night during the news. And do people just don't notice it, or how does it work, Karim?
We do notice it. This is what's fascinating about Lebanon. The civil war is not just a historical episode. It's like a living scar. It is a ghost that still haunts the political institutions, the social fabric of society, our collective memory. And I totally agree with what Dalal said. The problem is not that there's a multiplicity of narratives. In every country, in the United States, many people view the civil war with different opinions. For some, the Confederate flag is not problematic. What is needed in Lebanon is contrapuntal readings, point and counterpoint, for everyone to be able to engage with the other parties suffering in order to be able to move forward. Every single community has committed the same mistakes throughout its history. They were in fear. They started looking for foreign patrons, for protectors outside the Lebanese borders. Recently, Hezbollah allied with Iran. In the 1970s, some Christians allied with Israel. Later, many parties turned to Syria for help. The time has come for all Lebanese to focus on state building, to build institutions that will allow their children to strive to reestablish this country's sovereignty. The real tragedy of Lebanon is that it was never a sovereign country. It was always a buffer state. It was always the place where foreign entities came to settle their scores. And today we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to start afresh, to have a clean break. However, we still have vested interests trying to maintain their old habits, and we still have the presence of Hezbollah. Although Hezbollah has been considerably weakened, they are not yet ready, apparently, to surrender all their weapons to the Lebanese army, which would be a prerequisite for Lebanese sovereignty to be restored.
Once again, Anthony Tawil, 1975, the Shah of Iran is still in power. There is no Hezbollah at the time. It's still, according to estimates, because there was no census at the time, Lebanon was still a Christian majority country, but that was changing fast. Mm-hmm. And the sort of the makeup of Lebanon changed during the civil war.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, you're asking. I'm not a political commentator nor a historian. I'm a documentarist, and yes, there was a complete shift of the society and the struggles in the country after the first 2 years of the war, and then it became and after the 1982 invasion of Israel, the war shifted to a more interconfessional conflict in our society from 82 until the end of the war. So definitely that had a very, I think, heavy impact on our society and the dynamic that we went out of the war with between us, the passive aggressiveness and the violence that was dealt with and unreconciled.
So flux, volatility, the vacant lot where people come to fight from the rest of the region, but at the same time, extremely frozen in that you're still playing by rules set by the French, as you said earlier, Dalal, in 1920.
Yeah, but just to go back to the demographics, François, there's no official census about the demographics in terms of like religious communities since 1932, and that tells you a lot. But I think there are two myths that needs to be kind of debunked when it comes to Lebanon. First, that this was a purely sectarian and religious conflict. It wasn't. This was a 15-year war, right? And the alliances shifted. The issues were changing. The actors were changing, right? Like what happened in the 70s was not what happened in the 80s. There were new actors, new foreign powers intervening and interfering. And it wasn't just because the Palestinians were operating on your territory. I think Karim mentioned this. It was a detonator, right? But there were internal divisions inside. And this takes me to the second myth, which is that this was the war of others. Yeah, there was a lot of regional interference, and it made things worse, and it became at some point the war of others. But it was not just that, to be honest. So you go back to the political system, to the National Pact in 1943 and the confessional power sharing system. This was not very sustainable. And at the same time, when you look at how the war ended, right, for Christians and Muslims and the changes that were made to the constitution, you're like, it took 15 years of war and so many killed to just change that. So if you look at the balance, it was 6-5 for the Christians, then it was 5-5. So not much change. And then the agreement that we reached was never implemented. Karim mentioned this too, the Taif agreement itself that was supposed to lead to a deconfessionalized.
This is 1989, 1990.
Yeah, was never implemented to this day. And today we have a prime minister, Nawaf Salam, who's a firm believer in the implementation of the Taif agreement. I mean, we didn't even try to implement what we agreed on in 1989. So I think it's important to, you know, to just debunk those two myths, that it's not religious, because also Christians killed Christians and Muslims killed Muslims for real. And then, you know, the Shias became a separate entity in the 80s after the invasion of Israel. But before, they were part of one of the two camps. There were regional dynamics at stake. It's very complex and complicated. But to say that this is a religious war only, or to say that this is the war of others, is just inaccurate, to be honest.
All right. And we've seen how different people watch it differently. For a generation of U.S. and French soldiers, there was the 1983 truck bombing by Hezbollah that killed 241 U.S. and 58 French military personnel. Here in France, there was also the hostage taking. French journalists, their names were read out daily at the start of each bulletin of the news. They were held for years in the 1980s. And you know, that's how the rest of the world, Ivakovich Shaheen, looked at Lebanon's civil war at the time and how they remembered it and how it was kept in the public eye. Your thoughts when you think back to those days?
Well, as we were saying earlier, the war started as, if we were to vulgarize it, there was a part of the Lebanese themselves who wanted to keep a status quo while others were challenging it. And as division started becoming more and more present between these two camps, as Dalal said, each of these factions basically turned to the outside. And that's how at some point it became what we, an expression that I don't really like, became the war of others. And then each of these outside camps were basically either backing in different ways different people, and so they had to, in a way, as war goes, suffer some of their own losses. As for how it was perceived by the media, well, I can't speak to that because, again, I did not live through the war itself. But as today's generation, we did inherit its maps, we did inherit its fears, and we did inherit its logics. And those are all things that we need to reckon with today in order to be able to build something out of the crisis that we're in today in a certain way.
And the movement of 2019, this was where there was protests against, well, basically all of those old players that we showed in that report. What's become of that?
Well, it's interesting because that was maybe the first time where you could see on the ground, between both young people and old people on the ground, you can see for the first time certain things that were done in common, certain sort of sparks of trying to live together because of, you know, how things go. You're in a protest, you help each other out, etc. But it never really got its moment. It was taken away. It even died before it was born. But that was the first time where you could see through the human eye certain things start to form between different factions, different people that after the entire war had like chosen not to live together or not to even try to build something together. But I think that those kinds of things, once they're taken away from you, have to start from scratch, basically, because they were never, it was never propagated, it was never put in a place where it can grow into something institutionalized for living together.
Anthony Tawil, what happened? It's now 5 years ago. That's a long time.
Yeah, it's a long time. Since
then, we've had COVID. We've had the Port of Beirut explosion, which you talked about in your book. There's been a lot that's happened since. Was that stillborn, this attempt to break through again those divides that Karim was mentioning earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, 2019 was a huge statement, but also a huge opportunity for us to actually, we started to work on the podcast before 2019 because we thought nothing else is coming and we need to go back and work on the memory of the civil war. And then when 2019 happened, we then thought it was obsolete now to go back this far long because we are experiencing a complete shift of the system and we are actually, it's within reach for us. At least it felt for a few maybe weeks, it felt within reach. And after that, the country went back and the dynamic went back to the same, I think, struggle, dynamic struggle and social struggle as what we've inherited since the Civil War. And it was clear to us that any conversation about adopting and discovering the multi-perspectivity of Lebanese, the different experiences, what people went through in order to be able to understand the other, understand the circumstances, understand what other communities also have endured and experienced.
And what kind of feedback have you gotten on this?
It was very positive from both from two generations, I think. It was very well received by the generation that lived the war, which is our parents, because it was the first time that we, exactly as has been said already, to give everyone a chance to express themselves, to open up about these personal stories, and to give them also validity that these 15 years that our parents lived weren't one block that was only titled the Civil War. So people fell in love, people opened shops, people lived, people experienced things. And I think giving them a voice, giving them a platform to put all these stories together was kind of therapeutic for them. And for the generation that didn't live the war, for us, for instance, my generation, I did not live the war. I don't remember. I was born in 86. My partner in the podcast, Cedric, is born in 87. It's completely, and we went to school and school did not teach us anything. Mm-hmm. And then your parents have the same, you know, have their own perspective. And even your school is homogeneous, so it carries one perspective in the end. For us, it was very important to bring the other's perspective, to discover the other stories of people, put them together and have listeners, which we hope we're doing through the podcast. And we have been getting a lot of, I think, positive feedback between people using the podcast as a catalyst to open the conversation with their parents. So it's also creating a dialogue, intergenerational dialogue, our generation and those that really held it in for so long and stayed silent. So,
Karim Emile Bitar, what's your personal experience on that? Are people opening up, talking more?
Yes, still they are quite frustrated. Eva alluded to something very important. The major stumbling block today, the main problem is this culture of impunity. The fact that there was zero accountability in the Beirut blast, in the financial crisis. And I think this goes back to the original sin of the post-war era. Just a couple of years after the war ended, an amnesty law was voted under pressure by the Syrian occupation forces, and Parliament basically decided that all warlords could get away with all their crimes and that they would become political players. This is why they are still active 30 years after this amnesty law. So until we have at least a few political figures, a few thuggish bankers, a few corrupt politicians or warlords who are held accountable, the Lebanese...
Yeah, there was the example of the governor of the central bank for decades who was involved in... alleged misdeeds.
Absolutely. He's currently under arrest, but many of his accomplices are still roaming freely. One of the good news of the past 2 months is that the investigation in the Beirut blast explosion has been reopened. The judge has been listening to witnesses who did not want to be auditioned and they had political protections. However, it will be a difficult struggle, reaching accountability. Until the Lebanese regain confidence in their state institutions, they will still look for protection. They will still go to their communal leaders, to their closest militia warlord who can offer this protection. Today, we have an opportunity to build a state. However, this means having the courage to confront the remnants of the ancien regime.
All right, let's talk about that courage. In recent weeks, Hezbollah has been hinting at a common national defense force, a weakened Hezbollah since the assassination of longtime leader Hassan Nasrallah by the Israelis, among the top leadership killed in attacks in recent months. At commemorations of the 50th anniversary of the civil war on Sunday, Lebanon's president called for the end of militia-based rule.
It's time to draw the final lesson from these 50 years since April the 13th. Any weapon outside the framework of the state or its authority puts Lebanon's interests at risk for more than one reason. The time has come for us to say nothing protects Lebanon except its state, its army, and its official security forces.
I don't know if you're a betting woman, Dal al-Mawad, but what would you wager? Is the moment come, as Karim says, perhaps, where you can have, like, in a normal functioning state, it's only the Lebanese army that has the monopoly of power, of armed power?
Listen, François, I think there's a real opportunity, as Karim said, and I think we're at a turning point. If we miss this opportunity, it might not come again. Hezbollah has weakened and the regional dynamics have changed. Look at Syria. The regime is no longer there. And it was offering protection and, you know, a passage for weapons and, you know, kind of helping with that. My worry is that if we don't grasp this opportunity, we're going to be doomed to go from one form of occupation to another. Hezbollah needs to, you know, surrender its weapon. I think there's kind of unanimity today at the political level with the premiership, but also with the president. I think there are regional and international dynamics to push for that. But also I'm worried, you know, about, you know, what's happening in the south. The Israelis are still in five, you know, posts. There are breaches to the 1701 every day. There are violations. And that gives legitimacy to groups like Hezbollah. We don't want that, right? But we also want to make sure that Lebanon gets to a point where, you know, weapons are just, you know, the prerogatives of the state. The state regains its sovereignty. I mean, one of the reasons why the war never ended to me is because our state never
The war never ended, in your view?
No. It never ended. The war never ended because the state, the Lebanese state, never regained its sovereignty. It's one of the reasons why the war happened, is because the Lebanese state gave up on its sovereignty. It allowed all kinds of militias to thrive and to be powerful. It never ended because the sectarian system that fueled the violence became the status quo. And it entrenched the power. The warlords turned into politicians, François. And they are more... They became more powerful. And by the way, they've used the specter of the war to stop us from any change. Every time the Lebanese demanded real change, we were told it's either us or chaos or return to the civil war. They've used the civil war against us. It never ended for so many reasons. One of them is the impunity that Karim is talking about. How can we move forward if no one has claimed responsibility and no one has been held accountable? And it's a vicious cycle of impunity. We're talking about the Beirut explosion. We're talking about so many other assassinations, political assassinations. We're also marking, you know, 15 years since the assassination of Prime Minister Hariri, 25 years since the end of Israeli occupation. I could go on and on. The violence never stopped. We actually normalized the violence. That's why the war never stopped.
Let me bring in Eva Kovic-Shain. Again, 50 years ago, in 1975, the entire region was in flux. And there is this sense right now that the same thing is happening again. Now, the panel has said that it's up to the Lebanese to solve Lebanon. But the fact that the stars are realigning regionally, what does that mean?
Well, it means exactly what was just said. It means that we have an opportunity that we can't let go of. It means that this is the moment where we can start putting things in motion. And for me, it's really important to say again that putting things in motion means two things. It does not mean just institutions and reform. It means also culture, shifting the culture in people's minds. So people stop voting for their sex. But people don't vote for their sex today because they're simply irrational. People vote for their sex because the system rewards it, because there's a whole network of clientelism around it. There's rewards that come with it. So we need to change that mentality little by little in order to get to a thing that's self-sustainable in its positivity moving forward. So I think that now is the moment where we have to start all of that at the same time slowly, because not one thing can work without the other on one end.
And we've saw at Beirut International Airport in recent days, there had been billboards that eulogized Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. They've now come down in their stead, ones that proclaim a new era for Lebanon. So I don't know if that's a sign of what that is a sign of at this particular point in time. Let me put it to you, Anthony Tawil. Again, it's about a new era for Lebanon, but have we talked about the old one? How much, you know, before we can move on to the new one?
Well, it's definitely, we're still carrying more and more things that we need to unpack, maybe, and address and reconcile with, that's for sure. But yeah, it is a great opportunity as well for us to end maybe a huge chapter that is maybe 50 years old now. And move forward maybe to something that is that has more peace, at least that has more where people are understanding of the other experience, and then all of us agreeing to a form of Lebanese identity that we fall under.
Because again, your the title of your podcast is about is an allusion to crossing front lines.
Yeah.
When you walk around those former front lines today, do you look at them differently?
I find it extremely interesting that and insane also that after all the stories that we've heard, that actually my understanding of where the war was happening compared to where my location is, which is basically 3 kilometers, and there was there was war happening 3 kilometers away and people were living their lives, or vice versa in the 70s. That for me is always a striking reality of how a very tiny space can live so much violence and be separated in that way and continue for so long to maybe live with the repercussions without really addressing it. And it just shows how much weight I think Lebanese carry from that period, and that needs to be addressed, and you know, we need to talk about it. So
Can I just say something on this? So when I was working on my book, I interviewed the women to talk about the Beirut explosion. But there's a whole chapter.
Again, remind our viewers, the Port of Beirut explosion of August 2020.
There's a whole chapter that ended up writing, which is called History Repeats Itself. Because some of these women, when I asked them about the Beirut explosion, they took me back to the Civil War. This tells you something, is that we never healed from our wounds. We just compiled trauma on top of trauma. And one form of violence triggers just another. Mm-hmm. And I think if we don't have that sort of collective healing, we cannot move forward. There was no national reconciliation. I don't even know if, you know, that is still possible today, but to me, it's important. Politicians tell you we don't want to reopen wounds, but the wounds, you know, were never closed. We're still bleeding. The mere fact that these women decided to talk about the Civil War, and they had very vivid and colorful memories of the Civil War when the Beirut explosion happened, tells you that we never overcame that. We are still carrying that burden. And that, I think, is a major obstacle to moving forward in Lebanon.
When you speak to your parents' generation, do you feel as though there's a Karim Emil Bitar, they're carrying this with them?
Absolutely. This is something that all Lebanese have in common. All of them are traumatized by a series of events. And I shouldn't be saying this as a political scientist, but I genuinely believe that Lebanon needs today psychiatrists, neuroscientists, psychologists, people who would help the Lebanese overcome these collective traumas, reconcile these memories in order to move ahead. And Lebanon remains vulnerable to external shocks. I'm quite scary because what I'm quite scared because what is happening in Syria, if Syria evolves towards fragmentation and we are seeing Turkish intervention, Israeli interventions, bombings of Syria, it will have immediately repercussions on Lebanon. So Lebanon will never be an island as long as there is no just and lasting peace in Israel-Palestine, as long as Syria does not stabilize, there is a risk of Lebanon paying the price. However, it's important for us Lebanese to accept some form of neutrality to try to keep our nation away from these regional confrontations. In the 60s, it was the so-called Arab Cold War. Today, it's the Saudi-Iranian confrontation, perhaps soon an American-Iranian confrontation. Lebanon has to be shielded, and only national unity, as the president said, can protect Lebanese national unity and a strong, efficient state.
Dawood Mohammed, you alluded earlier to experiences in places like the Balkans. I mean, you look at a place today like Bosnia, they have a cold peace. You look at a place like Northern Ireland, they have a cold peace too. It's not... The sectarian divide still exists.
I think it's the case of Lebanon. Like, the fighting stopped on the streets, but the conflict didn't stop. The divisions are still there. The narrative of you versus me is still there. The front lines move from the street, but they're still in people's minds. They're in our mindsets. And I think that's dangerous. And on top of that, if you are sitting, you know, on top of a volcano regionally, and you are so weak and divided on the inside, then you're bound to shake all the time. And if you don't have a sovereign and strong state, and I repeat, I think the main reason why the war happened is that the state gave up on its sovereignty. Sovereignty is essential. I agree with Karim. Shielding at some point Lebanon from what's going on is important. So, yes, but we have to address, there are essential questions, Francois, from the war that were never addressed, such as, you know, the relationship between the state and the citizens. You know, Eva was talking about the question of citizenship, you know, nationhood, sovereignty, all of these things, we never really address them. And come and ask a few Lebanese on a table, they won't agree, they won't have the same answer.
They won't agree. Anthony Tawil, the Lebanese who have a very vibrant diaspora around the globe, on every continent. What about there? Do the barriers break down when you're outside of Lebanon?
I think they have a very different experience, of course, leaving Lebanon. And I think they left at different stages also. So you have a generation that left at the early stages of the war and maybe have a completely different narrative compared to those maybe that are immigrating now. So also when approaching diaspora and putting them all in one, I think, demographic, maybe there is also more nuances in their experiences that, you know, is for us to discover and for us to give a voice to.
Eva Kovic-Shain, you prepared a special edition for this 50th anniversary. What was the fact that startled you the most in doing your research?
Well, the edition was prepared by a big team of people, so everyone worked on different things. What I think I can talk about is actually the difference of perspectives, because there's in our newsroom there's people from very different generations, and the different subjects each of them pitched were very telling of how they perceive things. So, for example, the youth writing about how the youth perceives it, which is not perceiving it at all in a way that was more or less the article that came out. The older people who talk about, who recount their stories because they were journalists here during the war, or just their perspectives, etc. There was a lot of audiovisual content as well, where we had fighters speak, and just hearing these voices, hearing these testimonies. I think what we all realized today, just looking at each other, was that, like, wow, that was a lot of war content for the past.
Did you feel the PTSD? Did you feel the PTSD that was described by Karim?
Well, in the accounts of certain members of the older generation, yes, definitely. But would I say that PTSD was the dominating factor? Probably not. There was a true feeling, at least in the newsroom, of trying to do something to move forward by informing, by shedding light on things. So, yeah, I would say more of that, although the PTSD was definitely there.
unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. So much to talk about on this. Eva Kovic-Shain, I want to thank you so much for being with us from Beirut. I want to thank as well Anthony Tawil, Dal Mawad, Karim Emile Bitar. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate. I wish we had more time.